Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, August 31st, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss updates on the fiduciary rule. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Jason Mendro, partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. After Jason's opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Jason. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Laura. Thanks to everybody for joining today. Let me just start by saying that I am one of the many attorneys who are involved in active litigation challenging the fiduciary rule. So it may happen at some point during the course of our conversation that you detect that I might have a perspective of some sort about this issue, and your ears would not be lying to you. So I would just reiterate what Laura said. The views that I express today are not the views of the Federalist Society or of Laura or of my clients or my firm. What you're hearing is all me today. So with that disclaimer aside, let's get started talking about this awful, awful rule. As I'm sure all of you know, the Department of Labor published the fiduciary rule on April 8th, 2016. And in a nutshell, what the fiduciary rule does is ban broker-dealers and insurance agents from making commissions on their sales of investment products to IRAs unless they accede to a new code of conduct and unless they also agree to enter into contracts with their clients that are designed to subject them to private lawsuits, including class actions. That's the bottom line. And the rub is that the Labor Department has no affirmative power to regulate the IRA market and no authority to create private claims either. I know that a lot of people on this call today are bound to be very familiar with all of this and intimately familiar with the blow-by-blow of the fiduciary rule, let's say, weathered veterans and fiduciophiles, but I also know that there are a lot of people who are on the call who are probably still trying to figure out how all of this works and also trying to understand why it's been so controversial. So at the risk of perhaps restating some things that some of you know, I am going to take a step back and attempt to break this down a little bit step by step. I do promise that toward the end of the discussion, we will move on to the recent events, as recent as this morning, and open the floor to discussion about just how terrible this rule is. So taking it from the top, the rule really operates, I would say, in two steps. The first step is sort of the namesake step of the rule. And the first step is that the rule changes the longstanding definition of the term fiduciary, both under ERISA, which governs employer-sponsored retirement plans, and also under the tax code, which governs IRAs or individual retirement accounts. And it defines the term fiduciary in a way such that it includes just about everybody who sells retirement investments of any kind. Now, that's a big change because before, the term fiduciary generally applied to advisors to employer-sponsored retirement plans and financial advisors who had broad discretion to manage and invest the assets of their clients, who generally paid them a fee periodically, quarterly or yearly, based on the amount of the assets that they managed for those clients. And these traditional fiduciaries were governed by ERISA and by the Investment Advisors Act. And their role was analogous to that of a trustee acting for the benefit of beneficiaries to a trust. And that's why they had duties of loyalty and duties of care. They were parties to special relationships of trust and confidence. Now, on the other hand, the term fiduciary had not applied to people who simply competed in the marketplace of investment products and tried to sell their products to consumers at arm's length. This category of people generally included broker-dealers and insurance sales agents. They worked to sell a variety of products, including stocks and mutual funds and annuities. They, of course, had to explain those products to potential customers at times, but they didn't have any special relationship of trust and confidence with those customers. The distinction between the trustee-like fiduciaries on the one hand and the arm's-length salespeople on the other was very well established at the common law. It was also codified in the Labor Department's own prior rule. In 1975, the Labor Department adopted a rule that recognized that someone was not a fiduciary unless they met the conditions of a five-part test. And that test made it very clear that someone was a fiduciary only if she rendered individualized investment advice to her customer on a regular basis. So for 40 years before the adoption of the fiduciary rule, the Labor Department itself expressly recognized that an ongoing and personalized advisory relationship was essential to being a fiduciary. In other words, there had to be a relationship of trust and confidence as was recognized at common law. Now, the fiduciary rule changed all that. It deemed virtually everyone who sells investment products to be a fiduciary. You don't need to have any prior or ongoing relationship with the customer. You don't need to hold any kind of position of trust. Now, merely recommending that a complete stranger buy your product is investment advice that makes you a fiduciary, which is somewhat ironic because ERISA actually forbids traditional fiduciaries from selling their products to beneficiaries. So this is quite a radical departure from all prior understanding of what it means to be a fiduciary. It's the imposition of a trust standard in the absence of any relationship of trust. So what? That may be the question that some of you are asking. What's so bad about being called a fiduciary? We've all been called much worse. Well, words have consequences, and here the consequences are particularly significant. If you're deemed a fiduciary, then you're forbidden from receiving sales commission, plain and simple. Both ERISA and the tax code prohibit fiduciaries from engaging in certain transactions that could be considered self-interested. And that's because traditional fiduciaries owe a duty of loyalty to their beneficiaries, and that duty requires that they set aside their own interest. Sales of products for commission is among the listed prohibited transactions. So the bottom line here is that being a fiduciary means no commission. Now, as you can imagine, this is a big problem for broker-dealers and for insurance salespeople because commission has long been the cornerstone of their compensation model. It's been the cornerstone for decades. As we already discussed, investment advisors, who had always been understood to be fiduciaries, receive a periodic fee, usually annually, sometimes quarterly, based on the amount of investments that they manage. But sales professionals like brokers and insurance agents don't receive those fees. In many cases, the only way that they get paid at all is through commission. So the consequence of the fiduciary rule was basically to outlaw their business. And I'll just pause here to note that commission payments are a much better deal for many types of investors than the annual or quarterly fees. If you have a modest sum to invest, you may not even be able to find a fiduciary investment advisor. Because investment advisors are paid based on the size of the accounts that they manage, they often require substantial account minimums. Furthermore, for many investors, a buy-and-hold strategy is the best approach. This might include buying a mutual fund or an annuity that will be held for the long term for retirement. And when you buy and hold, commissions are often cheaper because they occur once than paying fees every single year for an account that doesn't even really need to be managed. The Labor Department has acknowledged this too. It said that it would be unreasonable to move certain investors who are in commission-based arrangements into a managed fee arrangement. Yet the fiduciary rule that the Labor Department adopted effectively outlaws the commission model with certain important exceptions. So what are the exceptions? Now this is really the key, and this is what I describe as the second step, sort of the backdoor regulation step of how the fiduciary rule works. What I want to emphasize is that the exceptions to the rule really are the rule itself. The fiduciary rule has no genuine purpose other than to force people into its exceptions. So let me just kind of explain what I understand to be the basis for how this all came together. The Labor Department, at least as it was composed at the time when this rule was adopted, disliked the fact that ERISA advisors were subject to fiduciary duties and people who sold retirement products to owners of IRAs were not. And the Labor Department disliked this even more as IRAs became more prevalent and as it became increasingly common for people to take funds that they might have saved through an employer account and roll those funds over into an IRA. The Labor Department was dissatisfied with the protections that Congress created for retirement savers and IRAs. And although the SEC was really the agency charged with overseeing investment professionals who provided services to IRAs, the Labor Department wasn't satisfied with the SEC's regulations either. So it set out to rewrite the standards for these investment professionals itself. And it faced one major roadblock. The Labor Department, being the Labor Department, had no authority to impose standards of conduct on investment professionals outside the context of employer-sponsored retirement plans. It is, after all, the Labor Department. It's charged with regulating labor and employment, not securities, not insurance, not financial markets, not investments at large. And apart from having no authority to impose the standards of conduct that it really wanted to have for IRAs, the Labor Department also had no authority to enforce those standards. So DOL had to find a way to regulate the IRA market and had to find a way to make sure that someone else was going to enforce the rules that it wanted. So how did it do that? Where it turned was to its exemptive authority, which is the power to create exemptions to the prohibited transaction rules that we just discussed. Now, this still might not make complete sense if you haven't been following the history of this regulation very closely, but let me try to clear it up. ERISA governs employer-sponsored retirement plans, as we've discussed, and the Labor Department both implements and enforces ERISA. But the tax code governs IRAs, and that's what the Labor Department wanted to try to regulate here. The Labor Department generally doesn't have any authority to implement the tax code, and it certainly doesn't have any authority to enforce it. In fact, Congress put the Treasury Department in charge of the tax code and carefully spelled out Treasury's authority to enforce the tax code by imposing excise taxes, and particularly imposing excise taxes for violation of the prohibited transaction requirements. So how is it that the Labor Department can achieve its goal by regulating IRAs through its exemptive authority? The answer is that ERISA and the tax code have a lot of parallel provisions, and in fact, they have a lot of parallel terms and parallel prohibited transaction provisions in particular. So as a matter of administrative convenience, the reorganization plan of 1978 gave the Labor Department two narrow slivers of authority over the tax code. One was that it could define certain overlapping terms, like the term fiduciary, and the other was that it could grant exceptions from the overlapping prohibited transaction rules in both statutes. So the power to define terms and to grant exemptions was the Labor Department's key to seizing authority over the regulation of IRAs. So, along with the new definition of the term fiduciary, what the Labor Department did was adopt new exemptions. And the most important and controversial of those exemptions is the best interest contract exemption, which is commonly referred to as the BIC exemption for short, or sometimes as the BICE, B-I-C-E. The BIC exemption says to brokers and insurance agents, hey, you can have your commissions back. All you have to do is agree to these standards of conduct, which we'll call the impartial conduct standards. And, oh, you also have to enter into these written contracts with all of your clients, guaranteeing them that you'll serve their best interest. And the contract has to make clear that they can now sue you, including in class actions. So that's the 1-2 punch of the fiduciary rule. First, the Labor Department redefined, the term fiduciary in a way that outlawed commissions for anyone who sold products to IRAs. And second, it allowed commissions again, but only if brokers and insurance agents acquiesced to the impartial conduct standards. And because the Labor Department itself had no power to enforce those standards, it essentially subcontracted enforcement to the class action bar by creating these contractual rights to sue. That is the fiduciary rule. So why should we care about this? I'm almost done with my overview at this point, but there's one more question that some of you might be asking. What is so terrible about requiring brokers and insurance agents to look after the best interest of retirement savers, setting the issue of authority aside? Well, the rule affects different industries that are subject to a host of different regulations by different regulators, and different professionals certainly have a wide range of views on that question. But for my part, I haven't heard a lot of objection to the concept of best interest. Most brokers and insurance salespeople will tell you that they always put their clients' interest first, that they do that as a matter of course as professionals, irrespective of their commission pay. They're also already subject to extensive regulation, including strict professional standards. Insurance agents are regulated by state insurance authorities. Broker-dealers are regulated by the SEC and by FINRA. And significantly, they're subject to a suitability standard, which says that they're only allowed to sell investments that are suitable for their clients. And FINRA has construed the suitability standard as a best interest standard repeatedly. So in other words, registered broker-dealers are already operating under a best interest rule without the fiduciary rule. So with the caveat that I gave at the outset, I don't think that the best interest concept is the controversial part of the fiduciary rule. What I think is the most controversial and problematic part of it is the blatant power grab by the Labor Department. These regulations are clearly the province of the SEC. In fact, Section 913G of the Dodd-Frank Act specifically directs the SEC to examine the issue of the standards that that govern broker-dealers. And it empowered the SEC to change those standards if it felt that that was appropriate. The backdoor regulation that the Labor Department has pursued simply through its exemptive authority, really has the effect of erasing the boundaries of its authority altogether. Just imagine this. Imagine if the SEC prohibited public companies from listing their stock on an exchange unless they agreed that they would abide by overtime rules that the SEC imposed. Everyone would know that that is an overreach of the SEC's authority. Of course, the fiduciary rule will also mean that there's more duplicative regulation by multiple authorities. The costs of compliance have already been extraordinary, and they will continue to be enormous going forward if the rule is permitted to come into full effect. The creation of competing standards will lead to confusion among customers and among professional service providers. And although the fiduciary rule is written to focus on retirement products, there can be no doubt at all that it's going to have much further reach. It's not always going to be clear which investment accounts are for retirement and which are for other types of savings. It won't always be practicable for an investment professional to operate under different standards. So what we really have in effect is the Labor Department adopting sweeping new regulation that will affect virtually all investment services. People are also very concerned about the new litigation that's going to come out of the fiduciary rule, and rightly so. It's very well settled that only Congress can create new private claims. I'm sure that this audience is well aware of that, but people in the public at large aren't always familiar with that concept. The Labor Department has basically dispensed with that principle through its contract requirement. The department has said it isn't creating new claims, but on the face of the rule, the department has acknowledged that the only reason for requiring the best interest contract is to provide a mechanism for enforcing the new code of conduct that the department itself lacks the power to enforce. And it also creates limitations on where the claims can be brought and what types of claims can be brought and what procedures apply, including by requiring that class actions be available. So whatever you call it, this is clearly the creation of new private liability. That's the intent of the rule, and that's the effect of the BIC exemption. And that liability has certainly not been authorized by Congress. All of this can also have very real and very adverse effects on retirement savers. If commission sales become less attractive, then there's obviously going to be a shift out of commission arrangements into managed fee arrangements. And those accounts, as I've already said, are not always available to savers with modest means. Another way of putting this is that there's a real risk, and a serious risk, that the fiduciary rule will reduce the availability of retirement saving services to many types of savers. There's also going to be fewer brokers that are hitting the streets and encouraging people to save for retirement. So the Labor Department might be reducing commissions or reducing the amount of commission arrangements at the expense of also reducing the number of people who will actually save for retirement at all. So I don't really think it is about best interest. I think what really is at stake here, to sum it all up, is extraordinary costs from new overlapping regulation, a possible reduction in valuable services to investors, sweeping new legal liabilities and lawsuits, and a blueprint, really, for a radical new approach to regulation that, if condoned, would allow just about any agency to regulate just about anything. So that's kind of my background. Let's talk a little bit about the timeline and what's happening now. So as I said at the outset, this rule was published on April 8 of 2016. It had a nominal effective date of June 7 of 2016, but in truth, the effective date wasn't really meaningful. No significant requirements actually took effect on the effective date. It wasn't a compliance deadline of any kind. Instead, the real compliance deadline for the fiduciary rule was labeled the applicability date, the date when various requirements would become applicable. And the applicability date was originally scheduled to be on April 10 of this year. And that's changed, as I'm about to discuss. And there have been a lot of developments that have contributed to that change. The first of those developments that I think is really worth highlighting is that on February 3rd of 2017, President Trump issued a memorandum to the Labor Department that was published in the Federal Register on February 7. And what that memo did was direct the Labor Department to reexamine the rule and to consider a lot of things, including whether the rule was actually going to have the effect of reducing access to investment services and whether the rule was also going to increase litigation. On April 7, which was just really moments before the April 10 applicability date, the Labor Department granted an extension of the rule. And the extension was kind of in two parts as well. Many of the requirements of the rule were extended just to June 7 of this year, and that included the date when the new fiduciary definition itself would take effect. So again, kind of the namesake step of the fiduciary rule. It also included the deadline for complying with the Labor Department's new impartial conduct standards as a condition of qualifying for the exemption. But all that being said, other important deadlines were pushed out further to January 1 of the coming year. And so this extension, the January 1 extension, applied to a lot of disclosure requirements that would have concerned fees and services and conflicts of interest. This is a little bit nuanced, but that longer extension also applied to the availability of what's known as PTE 8424. That's another exemption to the prohibited transaction requirements of ERISA and the tax code. And that's an exemption that was a lot less burdensome than the BIC exemption, the best interest contract exemption, and that was previously available for a wide range of annuities and mutual fund shares. But one of the things that the Labor Department did in the fiduciary rule, quite surprisingly, is revoke that exemption, the 8424 exemption, for fixed index annuities in the final version of the rule. And the reason why I say that was surprising is because the proposed version of the rule that the public commented on didn't say anything about revoking 8424 for fixed index annuities. That really was first known at the time that the final rule was published. But the most important deadline that was extended until January 1st was the deadline for entering into the very controversial written contracts, the best interest contracts. So that was the extension that the department published on April 7. I think the next sort of significant development was on June 1st. On June 1st, the new chairman of the SEC, Chairman Clayton, issued a request for public comments on the standards that really should be applied to brokers and other types of investment advisors. And the request was very clear that the SEC was assessing taking possible future actions. Chairman Clayton made some interesting observations in that request, and one of them, and this is going to be a quote, quote, "The Department of Labor's fiduciary rule may have significant effects on retail investors and entities regulated by the SEC. It also may have broader effects on our capital markets. Many of these matters fall within the SEC's mission of protecting investors, maintaining fair, orderly, and efficient markets, and facilitating capital formation," end quote. So I think that observation is undoubtedly correct. As I said before, the Dodd-Frank Act specifies that this regulatory space is the SEC's regulatory space. The SEC was asked to consider whether to promulgate this type of rule and was empowered to do it, and the Labor Department was not. So I think that was a pretty significant development at the beginning of June. Then I'll fast forward to July 6th. On July 6th of 2017, the Labor Department issued its own request for information on two different topics. First, it asked whether the remaining deadlines that were going to set in on January 1 should be further extended. So again, this included the best interest contract requirement as well as the 8424 issue and a host of disclosure requirements. And the second issue that the Labor Department requested information about was really in line with the questions that were raised in President Trump's earlier memorandum, such as whether the rule should be amended or changed or repealed, and whether there should be different prohibited transaction exemptions to the rule if it remains in place. Comments in response to that request for information were due in July and August. And just on the issue of the extension alone, the Department of Labor received about 60,000 comments. On August 9th of 2017, we saw the first hint that the Labor Department was actually contemplating taking action in response to the comments about the extension. And I'll talk a little bit about the litigation in a moment, but in one of the cases that was pending in the District of Minnesota, the Labor Department filed a document suggesting that it was planning to extend the applicability date from January 1 back to July 1 of 2019. And just yesterday, we really saw the Labor Department acting on that suggestion. Yesterday in the afternoon, the Labor Department published on its website a new proposed rule. And just this morning, so this is real time, we're all here in the middle of history, just this morning, that new rule was published in the Federal Register. And the Labor Department is requesting comments on the new proposal in 15 days. So the comments are due on September 15th. So assuming that the Labor Department finalizes the proposed extension, it will again postpone all the deadlines that were set for the first of the coming year. And again, that will include the deadline for entering into the written contracts. It will also extend the deadline for the disclosure requirements. And it will provide a further extension of the availability of PTE 8424 for fixed index annuities. So what is the Labor Department proposing exactly, and what comments is it requesting? Well, currently it's proposing to extend all of those timelines by 18 months, so that the new deadline would be July 1st of 2019. But interestingly, the department is actually considering a couple other options as well. First, it's also requesting comments about the possibility of granting an extension that, rather than running until a date certain, some specified date, it would instead kind of be a floating deadline that would run for some specified period after the department finishes the review that the president directed it to conduct. So it would be something of a contingent date. The department has expressed some concern that that approach wouldn't be sufficiently certain. So it's actually also considering a third option, which is, it's referred to as the tiered approach, and basically that would be an either-or sort of date. The way that the tiered approach would work is that the deadlines would be extended to the earlier of a specified date, like July 1, 2019, or some period after the occurrence of a specified event, which I think it's reasonable to infer that the Labor Department is thinking that the event would be at the conclusion of its work directed by the president. Whatever approach it takes, the Labor Department gave a number of interesting reasons for proposing an extension at this time, and I'll walk through those. First, the department explained that it's concerned that regulated parties could be forced to incur undue expenses if they have to comply with all of these conditions by January 1, and that might be a waste if the department, in the fullness of time, determines that it needs to revise or repeal those requirements. Second, the department says that it needs more time, and this is a quote, to honor the president's directive to take a hard look at any potential undue burdens, end quote. And the department won't be able to decide whether to change the rule or its exemptions before it completes that work. Third, and I think this is potentially very significant to all of our clients, the department already anticipates that it will propose in the near future a new and more streamlined class exemption, which it says will be built on recent innovations in the financial services industry. But the department says it won't be able to finish its work on that new exemption by January 1 either. And fourth, the department took note of SEC Chairman Clayton's request for information, and the department says that it now wants to coordinate with the SEC about possible changes to the rule. So all of those were considerations that the department specifically cited in its proposal to exchange the rule in some form or fashion, most likely by extending the remaining deadlines by 18 months. The most important takeaways from my standpoint are that the department is already contemplating a new streamlined class exemption, that the department is now acknowledging the importance of coordinating with the SEC on these matters, and I also found it interesting that the proposal expressly states that the department has set an objective to complete its reevaluation of the rule in response to the president's memorandum by July 1 of 2019. I think that could have been inferred from the length of the duration, but it's interesting that the department said that specifically. The department also, along with the proposal for the extension issued a non-enforcement bulletin. This is actually the third non-enforcement bulletin the department has issued. And what that does, it states that the department is not going to pursue any claims at this time against any fiduciary within the meaning of the new rule based on its failure to satisfy the BIC exemption or a closely related exemption known as the principal transactions exemption. There's another interesting element to the non-enforcement bulletin, which it makes it a little bit different than the earlier two. This one also says that the Labor Department isn't going to treat anyone as being in violation of the conditions of the exemptions merely for failing to restrict their arbitration agreements in the way that the rule directed. And I'll say another word about that when we get into the litigation, but I just wanted to flag that while we're talking about the most recent development, which is this proposed extension. So with that, let me just shift gears to the litigation. Against the backdrop of all of these developments, all the president's memo, the extensions, the non-enforcement bulletins, there has been wide-ranging litigation waging in the background, and it's been going on for well over a year. The first case that was filed on June 1st of 2016, and that's our case. That case was brought by the Chamber of Commerce and CIFMA and several other large trade associations in the Northern District of Texas. And the arguments we make in that case are probably going to come as no surprise to anyone who's been listening to me talk on this call, because I've been alluding to them throughout. But we argued that the rule unlawfully construes the term fiduciary in a manner that's incompatible with its settled meaning. We argue that the Labor Department exceeded its authority by extensively regulating the IRA market, which it really doesn't have any affirmative authority over at all, just by utilizing conditions of its exemptive authority. We've argued that the Labor Department exceeded its authority by creating a private right of action that Congress didn't utilize or authorize, and we've argued that that's a clear violation of Alexander v. Sandoval, a Supreme Court case that makes it, I think, really settles the issue that agencies can't create new private rights of action. Only Congress can do that. We argued that the Labor Department placed unreasonable limits on arbitration in violation of the Federal Arbitration Act. And we also argued that the rule is arbitrary and capricious in violation of the Administrative Procedure Act for a number of reasons. Other large trade associations also filed suit in Texas shortly after we did, and their cases were consolidated with ours. By and large, they asserted many of the same fundamental claims. They also added further arguments about why the rule is arbitrary and capricious with a focus on annuities. And they argued that the rule places unreasonable burdens on commercial speech in violation of the First Amendment. Other lawsuits were also filed in other federal courts around the country, one in D.C., one in Kansas, and another in Minnesota. And all of those lawsuits are still pending today at various stages. One important note about the litigation to date, and this is what I was alluding to before, is that the Labor Department has now conceded that we are right at least about the Federal Arbitration Act issue, that it is a violation of the Federal Arbitration Act to tell the public and to tell financial institutions in particular that they can't qualify for these exemptions that they need to continue their business unless they agree that they won't include class waivers in their arbitration agreements. So the Labor Department is no longer defending the provisions of the BIC and parallel exemptions that would have barred financial institutions from including those class waivers and arbitration agreements. And I think that one reason why that new language we have, we now see in the latest non-enforcement bulletin might have been included is an acknowledgement of the fact that the Labor Department isn't actually defending that limitation on arbitration agreements anymore. So finally, what's next? I think I've probably signaled that throughout the course of this discussion. The comment period has begun. The alarm has sounded, and the department is now considering comments on its recent proposal to extend the deadline for complying with the contract requirement, among other requirements, for 18 months to July 1, 2019. It's also considering those other options we discussed. We're all anxiously awaiting the Fifth Circuit's decision in the Chamber of Commerce case, which is the case that's furthest along. Let me just say kind of where that litigation is. Our challenge was litigated initially unsuccessfully through the district court. We, along with the other plaintiffs who filed in the Northern District of Texas, have all appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and argument was heard on July 31st. So that case is now awaiting decision. It's fully briefed and fully argued, and so that is the case that's furthest along. The other cases are in various stages of appeal with briefing ongoing and without argument scheduled yet. So we're all waiting to see what the Fifth Circuit decides. And in the meantime, the SEC is hard at work at examining this issue. So I think that's probably more than enough background. I hope that that was helpful and not too redundant of things that folks already know. But this is probably a good time to open the floor to discussion and questions.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing an audience question, I'll ask one of my own. If the Fifth Circuit rules against the government, what would be the definition of fiduciary?
Thank you. That's a good question. If the Fifth Circuit decides the case by vacating the new fiduciary definition, then basically the definition will be reversed, and what will happen is the rule that was previously in place since 1975 will take effect again. That was the five-part test. Part of the rule was replacing the test. So if the rule is vacated, that test will come back into force.
Let's go to our first audience question.
Hello, thanks for this. It's been very helpful for me. Can you just say a word about how much the sort of threat of this regulation coming into full force has changed the business practices on the ground already, or have the delays and Trump's election sort of made it such that people have mostly been taking a wait-and-see attitude?
Well, I would say that's also an excellent question. Thank you. I would say that practices have changed in some ways, and in other ways they haven't changed. The way that I think they haven't changed is, and I kind of hinted at this before, I think that insurance agents and broker-dealers alike would tell you that they operate functionally under a best interest standard. And I think with broker-dealers it's more than functional, because their regulator, FINRA, has effectively construed the suitability requirements to require a best interest standard. So I don't think that will be different. I think that most of these, there's certainly bad actors in every profession, but I think by and large, people would say the imposition of the best interest standard is something that they've long observed. In terms of ways in which things are changing, what we have seen is the development or the attempt to develop new types of mutual fund products and new types of investment products that would levelize fees. One of the things that has been discussed quite a lot are T-shares. There's been a lot of discussion also of clean shares. And part of what the Labor Department has said in the recent proposal to extend the deadlines is that it would like for there to be more time for industry to try to work on creating those types of new products. And the other, I think, sort of big reveal, big news from the proposal is that the department is already considering a new class exemption that is based on what the department views as innovations in the financial markets. So I think what we'll see in the fullness of time is that there have been new product ideas. Those are developments that may have occurred in the absence of this rule, but they've certainly developed since the rule became final. And so I think that is a bit of a change. But I don't think that best interest is new. And I think, fingers crossed with any luck, there won't be best interest contracts, which to my mind are really just sort of a handout to the plaintiff's bar.
Great. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, I have a question, and this may be a little too much in the weeds, but in the Minnesota case, the Thriving case, which goes to arbitration, the government seems to be opposing, suggesting, I should say, a stay. And I wondered if you thought that the FAB that they issued is part of their litigation strategy.
Yes, yes, and yes.
You wouldn't really need that non-enforcement. I mean, if the BIC is not effective, you don't need a non-enforcement statement.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the design of including that additional language is to make that case look moot.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought too. Thank you.
You bet.
I'll make another call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll take a moment for a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for a week from today, on Thursday, September 7th at 1 p.m. That call will feature a discussion on patent law and antitrust, and will include a number of speakers, including Mr. Philip Johnson, Senior Vice President at Intellectual Property Strategy and Policy at Johnson & Johnson, Mr. Roger Martin, Senior Vice President and Chief IP Strategist at Qualcomm, Professor Kristen Osenga, Professor of Law at the University of Richmond School of Law, and Mr. Howard J. Klein, Attorney at Klein, O'Neill, and Sinn. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for the next question, Jason, do you think the government will appeal if it loses in the Fifth Circuit?
Well, my first reaction is I hope that I'll get to find out. If the government loses, I think it certainly should not appeal. There are a lot of different ways we could win. There's a lot of different reasoning that would support an outcome in our favor. If we win, as I hope we will, I think the government is probably going to consider the reasoning in the decision, in informing its own decision on what to do. But my strong view is that if the Fifth Circuit were to decide that the Labor Department lacks authority to regulate this space, as we have argued, then it should end this project, and it should defer to the SEC, which is the agency that Congress selected to regulate this area and which is actively analyzing the issue right now. There's not anything that the Labor Department can do to fix its lack of authority, so some sort of compromise rule that might include new exemptions simply doesn't make sense to me.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any. Jason, would you like to make some closing remarks?
My only closing remark is that it's been fun. Thank you all for listening today, and thank you, Laura, for setting it up and hosting.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.